everybody. Welcome back to the Glory Glory Man United podcast. I'm your host, as always, Kyle Quinn. And joining me today is Chris Nugent. And we're going to discuss Manchester United's sensational comeback victory over Aston Villa, which is not the first time this has happened in the Premier League era, where we came from behind to beat Aston Villa. And remarkably, Aston Villa, this is a stat that I heard last night, have only beaten us five times in the Premier League era. And their fans were elated when they were 2-0 up at Old Trafford, thinking this is uncharted territory. United are in disarray and we're already 2-0 up after 26 minutes. We're going to cruise to victory here and we're going to enjoy this because it's a rare occasion. But once again, United come back to beat Villa 3-2. Well, so what are your thoughts, Chris?
Yeah, I enjoyed it thoroughly, Kyle. Absolutely brilliant. I enjoyed every bit of it. It's one of them weird ones because if you'd have said to me beforehand, or should I say, if the match went a different way and we won 3-2, but with being like 3-0 up and then they came back with two or, you know, something like that, it wouldn't have felt so good. But just in a way, ironically, going 2-0 down just makes it feel amazing. So it was a brilliant, it felt like a brilliant finish. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and everybody remembers 14 years ago when we were 2-1 down to Aston Villa at Old Trafford in the title race with Liverpool. And Michaela to win us the game 3-2 after Ronaldo scored twice. There was one man who played in both of those games. He played against Aston Villa in 2009 and he played against Aston Villa last night. Who was it, Chris?
Johnny Evans.
Absolutely. He seems to be always around for these big comeback wins against Aston Villa.
Written in the stars.
Yeah, and Makeda scored the winner. He famously screamed into the camera lens. And last night, he was celebrating with Rasmus Højlund when he scored his first Premier League goal for Manchester United. And you could just see it in his face, how much it meant to the young lad. He was almost crying tears of joy, wasn't he?
He was, Kyle. He was. Yeah, I was delighted for him. It's been tough for him. And Bruno Fernandes, I saw he did an interview after the game. And he was talking to Patrice Evra and they were making comments. And they basically made the comment, which is 100% true. The criticism and the scrutiny at Manchester United is just 10 times any other club in England for sure. And it's, you know, it's as big as it is at clubs across the world. So yeah, he'd been under pressure. You know, at other clubs, he wouldn't have been under any pressure at all. They would have said, oh, he's got a few Champions League goals. Yeah, okay, he needed to go. So it was, I'm sure it felt just better for him because of all that he finally got his first Premier League goal. Yeah, he took really well. Brilliant goal, took it really well. So, and obviously it was the winner as well. So just everything just came together perfectly for him. It was lovely to see.
Yeah, it had been a long time coming. As you say, he'd only scored in the Champions League. And it's taken him to Boxing Day to score his first Premier League goal. But the star of the show was definitely Alejandro Garnacho, scoring twice, having a goal disallowed for offside. A very, very tight offside decision yet again, just as the game at the Emirates, where we thought Garnacho scored the winner against Arsenal. But fingernails in it again. But another fantastic display from the young man, fast becoming United's talisman this season. And it was the first time, really, where Ten Hag started him on the right-hand side. And it looks as if we've had many issues with finding a permanent person on that right-hand side. We've tried several players, and it hasn't really worked out. I mean, Anthony's been poor. Palestri only really comes off the bench. And the few games he has started, he didn't do that well in. And you know, he's tried Rashford out there, he doesn't want to play out there. Obviously Greenwood's not at the club currently, so he may have stumbled across a solution with Alejandro Garnacho, and I really want to see him continue there against Forest. In fact, I would start with the same team against Forest, with the exception probably of Shaw coming back in at left back instead of Dalot. Would you go along with that, Chris?
Yeah, I think that's fair, Kyle. Yeah, like you say, you know, well, I guess you could argue that defensively we weren't amazing, given that we shipped two goals in the early part of the game. But generally, yeah, I thought we obviously we came away with a win. So I can see that argument saying, yeah, fair enough to start with the same team, like you say, but with Shaw coming back in, which might make us just that wee bit stronger defensively, as we know Dalot isn't exactly the world's greatest defender going back. In terms of Garnacho, yeah, he was absolutely brilliant last night. I think on commentary, it was Ali McCoist that was just saying that he was really positive and aggressive in the sense of going, you know, taking the ball on, driving forward all times. He was just brilliant. And you're right, we've struggled a lot on that right hand side to get somebody who seems to be fit and able and willing to play there. And it could just be that that's a good place for Garnacho. I noticed last night though, he was all over the pitch. At times anyway, you know, he just loves getting the ball and driving through midfield and pushing forward. And yeah, he was absolutely brilliant. So no, I would be in favour of that. I think if we started with the same team, given that they're also just coming off, you know, a nice win like that, we'll have a bit of confidence. So I wouldn't argue with that, to be fair.
Yeah, and Rashford probably had his best performance of the season. Not that that would be difficult, but it seemed to be an improvement in what we've seen so far. Looked really up for it, and was heavily involved in Garnacho's first goal. So was Bruno. Great anticipation and leading to the interception, and then lovely ball to Rashford. He played a cross goal for Garnacho to stick away. So yeah, marked improvement by Rashford. So I think you definitely have to continue with that front three against Forest, because we've criticised the forwards all season for their lack of output, but last night was the absolute antithesis of that. I do have to mention the unsung heroes of last night as well, which was Eriksen and Manu in midfield. So great on the ball, so great in tight areas. And, you know, they're far more press resistant than any other combo that we have in midfield. I've seen like videos online today of like the goalkeeper plays the ball to one of them, then three Villa players converge on them. But because they're so good with their feet and such great vision, they're able to get out of those situations. And then you have a scenario where Villa have committed three men up the field. United have got out of the press, and all of a sudden, you know, we've got a numerical advantage when we're attacking. So that seems like something that should continue as well, that midfield three. Though my only concern was pre-game, was that it doesn't really have a great deal of pace, that midfield, but it didn't really matter because there's such fantastic technical players. Is that how you saw it, Chris?
Yeah, I think that's fair, Kyle. And the thing is about the pace, they don't necessarily need to have pace when they have people like Rashford and Garnacho running off them, because they have lots of pace, you know. So I think that, you know, it's fair enough for them, like you say, Kyle, having the ability to get out of those tight spots is absolutely huge, hugely important. And all them guys need to do, and what they're capable of doing, is spraying the ball around when they get out of those positions, you know, getting space to ping a pass to, you know, to Rashford or Garnacho, kind of running off them down the line. So yeah, I think you're right. I think having the lack of pace it only becomes important, I guess, whenever they're getting kind of overrun in midfield and they need to be able to get back. But yeah, that didn't happen last night, thankfully. So they coped really well. In terms of Eriksen and Mainu, both have absolutely wonderful ability with their feet. I thought Mainu was a little bit quieter last night than what he had been. But I thought they both played really well. My only criticism of Eriksen was nothing to do with his play midfield, but I think he the ball fell to him on the edge of the box, and instead of taking what looked like the obvious thing to do, which was to have a shot, and he's good. A good striker of the ball, he decided to try and lay it off. So I don't know if that's just maybe a wee bit of confidence with him, or he feels a bit rusty because he haven't had as much game time of late. That may only small criticism, but beyond that, yeah, you're right. I think they both played really, really well. And having that coolness under pressure is massively, massively important. So I like them both together for sure.
Yeah, there's certain players that are just a wee bit too generous, and maybe Eriksen is one of them. You know, we often talk about ruthless strikers who are selfish are always looking for the shot, but Eriksen probably the opposite of that, really. And sometimes that's to his detriment, but you know, overall he had a massively positive impact. Don't worry, Brish, we'll get on to the goalkeeper. We'll save that for later on. And I want to focus on the positives for the moment. So, Bruno Fernandes, it was another vintage Bruno Fernandes performance, wasn't it? At the thick of things, creating, tackling, tenacity. Definitely one of his better performances. And quite often the Dukes seem to come against Aston Villa. I do remember him scoring twice at Villa Park. Yeah, it's great to see him back in top form, isn't it?
He was brilliant last night. Really, really good, like you said. Everything that's good about Bruno Fernandes kind of came out last night. Working hard, running his socks off, and his passing was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And we know that he can do that, and he did it loads. He did it plenty last night, and that's why he's in the team. I think it's you can't. I know that he can be frustrating at times. He frustrates United fans, and he certainly seems to frustrate opposition fans, but. You know, you can't deny the guy's got he's a talented footballer, and when he's on it and he's in form, his passing range is as good as anybody I've ever seen at Man United, and that's lofty praise given some of the players we've had. But he really can ping the ball about everywhere. He's a class act when he's on it. He definitely is.
Yeah, and I was saying earlier online that. I think it was just being a wee bit cheeky, to be honest. But there was a lot of United fans who are like McTominay cheerleaders. And I've been saying in the last week or so that he should come out of the team because he's only scored in one game out of the last nine. And we should, you know, have a more technical players in there. Well, what I said was Casemiro, when he's fit, Manu and Bruno's a better midfield. Obviously, Casemiro was not available. So Ten Hag did decide to leave out McTominay and play Manu, Eriksen and Bruno as his midfield, and we reap the rewards of that. Like Tomlin might get the odd goal here and there, but I think that he is an impediment to us in midfield because he is not a very good technical player. He's not good on the ball. His passing range is very poor, just sideways, backways, sideways, backways. And the odd occasion he might get into the box, but as I say, that's only happened in one game. The last nine that he played, so I didn't really see the point in persisting with him. And last night, our midfield was excellent without him. So I know it might seem harsh, but you know, to be a Man United midfielder, you have to have a lot in your game. And McTominay is lacking in many, many key areas, in my opinion. Would you agree, Chris?
Yeah, I do, Kyle. I think that I think it's fine if you're, I think it's obviously kind of horses for courses. I mean, he's never going to be, you know, somebody who can spray the ball about like Bruno can. And I'm fine with that if you're doing everything else so well, you know, that you make up for it, you know, in the sense of winning the ball, you know, all over the place, you know, laying it off the people, you know, and chipping in with the odd goal, which he does tend to do. But unfortunately, you look at the likes of Manu, who's also very good at reading the game and also good at winning back the ball, but actually has that passing and that coolness in his locker that McTominay doesn't have. And unfortunately, that's what, to me, is what means that he probably, he's not offering anything that we can't get with somebody else, plus more from somebody else. And I think that's the problem. Like you say, Kyle, you know, at Manchester United, you know, we don't aim to, you know, do what we're doing right now, frankly, and sit around sixth or seventh position. You know, we want to be challenging for things. And unfortunately, McTominay, probably over the years, while he's got a lot of endeavour about him and stuff like that, and you can't argue with his commitment, I don't think he's going to have the quality to get you, you know, to league titles and winning things. You know, generally, you know, kind of year after year, he's just not going to do that. So, that's hard to disagree with you. But I can see why people like him. I don't dislike him at all. You know, we know that, unfortunately, at United over the last number of years, we've had a lot of players who don't even look like they're trying half the time. So the bar has almost been dropped to the point where if somebody really works hard, that's almost been viewed as enough. And I can see why that is. But if we want to start winning things, we need more than that. And I don't know if McTominay offers much more than just effort. I think that's probably not enough. So, yeah, I think I would tend to agree with you, in fairness, Kyle.
Yeah, there's been comparisons made to Don Fletcher because of their nationality and all that, but I think number one, I think Darren Fletcher was a better player, and two, I think Darren Fletcher probably surrounded by better players. So I just don't think McTominay is the right man for most occasions for United at the moment. Now, if he was surrounded by 10 Zidanes, then fine. But that hasn't been the case for, you know, all his United career, really. I just think that we should probably just cash in on him because of the goals that he gets on occasion. I think he's got 5 or 6 this season. United can use that to get decent money for him. I mean, West Ham are willing to pay 30 million for him in the summer. So I would consider, you know, any bids of that 30 to 40 million nature this summer, because, yeah, I don't think he forms part of United's best midfield. And I think he's a sellable asset you can get some decent cash for. So that's my thoughts on that. So we have to talk about Johnny Evans, who's exceeded our expectations, both in terms of his performances and the amount of times that he's played. We all thought he was going to be a bit poor player, maybe playing in the League Cup or the FA Cup against lower league opposition. But, I mean, he's probably been almost a mainstay at Manchester United's defence, apart from the few weeks that he missed through injury. And he's been tremendous. Last night, stopped John McGinn from scoring his second goal of the game with a terrific goal line clearance. But aside from the obvious, you know, moment like that, you could see how well he reads the game. You know, when a ball is played from Villa's midfield into the forward line, he's anticipating it. He gets out in front of his man, and, like, you know, like Paolo Maldini used to say, that if I'm having to tackle someone, you know, I've already failed in my job. And Evans is again reminding me of Maldini at the moment, because he's anticipating things. You know, he's reading the game well. You know, I used to be critical of him in his first spell at the club, because he would just he would have to make last-ditch challenges and often give away penalties. I remember a game against Liverpool at Old Trafford where Berbatov got the hat-trick. Gerrard scored a penalty in that game because Evans nearly sliced Fernando Torres in half by having to make a last-ditch challenge. But he's a totally different player now. He's so experienced, and we're reaping the benefits, aren't we?
Yeah, he's been magnificent. He really has been. You're right, Kyle. I would say that when Ten Hag brought him in, I don't think he would have anticipated that he would do so well, that he would want to use him quite as much as what he has, or maybe he did. I mean, but he's been magnificent. Yeah, I think I was texting you during the game last night, and maybe went too far by saying that he's a shout for man of the match. But I do think he played as well as anybody did last night. And like you say, Kyle, not just that clearance off the line. There was another couple of challenges that he made where he read, I think, a pass between two attackers close to the box or on the edge of the box. And just generally, you know, small things, getting in front of crosses, you know, really tight and knocking the ball out of play. It was just those small things that you kind of, it's easy to not notice in the heat of a game, but you think to yourself, if you're playing that game and he's your teammate, you're loving him. You're going, oh, flip me, Johnny's there. Johnny the rescue again. Oh, thank God Johnny got in front of that one. Oh, thank goodness Johnny got in front of that one. He was just, he just played really well. Like you said, Kyle, his reading of the game, clearly has improved. That's what experience at the top level has done for him. You know, fair play to Johnny Evans. He's been playing at the top level of English football for his entire career. And that shows, you know, that he's been doing that. He's magnificent. And yeah, I think we've been quite lucky that he's been willing to come back. And he's done really well. No, I thought he was brilliant last night, I have to say. Or I was really impressed by him. Yeah, thought he was great.
Yeah, there's a lot of debate in the recent months over the manager selecting Evans over Varane. But now, because of injuries, they're now playing together. Performed well last night and performed even better at Anfield. With the injuries to Maguire, Lindelof and Martinez, then he's had to play them. Even Varane was ill or something against West Ham, so he had to play the young lad, Willy Kambwala. He came on as a sub last night. So those are only really available, you know, centre-backs at the moment. And the young lad has looked good as well against West Ham. So you know, Harry, and is going to struggle to get himself back in the team.
Why do you sound so happy about that, Kat?
No, I wouldn't say I'm happy about it, but to be fair, Maguire was playing well, but he's probably not my favourite defender, if I'm being honest about it.
I've never heard you mention that before, Kat. This is new. This is all very new to me.
It would be new to no one who listens to this podcast. Yeah, so Ferran is just a world-class elite defender when he's on his game, and he has been in recent weeks, and Evans has been a revelation. So I would certainly continue with them two as much as possible. We're not going to be playing twice a week now. I mean, we only have three games in January. Well, if we get to the fourth round of the FA Cup, if we don't, there'll only be two. So there's no need to keep rotating and, you know, resting players. So Ferran and Evans could end up being a mainstay as long as they stay fit. It will be interesting to see what the manager It'll be interesting to see what the manager does when everybody's
agree, Kyle. Completely, and I think that's the key when everybody's available. Those two together seem to be great. They really do, like you said. They're experienced defenders. They've been playing both at high levels of football for a long, long time. Varane, his levels obviously go without saying. So yeah, I would like to see them play more often. That's the problem, unfortunately, with Varane, that he's just so often not available, which is very, very frustrating. And that's why sometimes, you know, maybe even when he is available, he's only come back from injury, or maybe there's a niggle that we don't know about and he's 50-50 and he says, oh, I'll play, but I'm not sure. And the manager thinks, I'm not gonna waste a sub if you're going to come off again. So I can see why sometimes he doesn't get selected. But yeah, based on what we've seen of late, like you said, Kyle, you have to say that those two together seem to be probably our best centre-back pairing. It's just a shame that, that Varane just often doesn't make himself available, which again elevates Johnny Evans in my mind, because that guy just always seems to make himself available. And it's you know, he seems to, like, he just wants to play every game. He's probably happy to be back at United and sees it as a privilege, I would imagine, and he's just savouring it. So yeah, I would just like to see Ferran a bit more available, a bit more often. But yeah, he's brilliant when he's available, for sure.
Yeah, I would just stick with him for now, because we're only really going to be playing once a week after the Forest match. I imagine Martinez will be an automatic selection when he comes in, and, you know, Evans will be a rotational option after that. He's probably our best defender. Maguire, he's had a decent season, so plenty of good options there now. But Lindelof probably sees himself bottom of the pile now. Which I'm not. He's had a dreadful season, so I would consider moving him on at the end of the season now, and then bringing in a good, like, 24-year-old, 25-year-old centre back. And we've linked with Toribio, the Nice centre half, who are flying high in Ligue 1. So if we could bring him in and ship off Lindelof, then that would be good business. Varane might go to Saudi Arabia in the summer as well. So yeah, but once we have everybody fit, we're going to have plenty of good options, I think. So that's good. And you wouldn't believe that, you know, we'd look so good at centre half with, you know, with three senior centre halves injured. You know, it's not often that would happen. Mm. Now, having said that, you know, the first two goals were a calamity from Manchester, conceded by Manchester United last night. And we were talking during the game, and I was saying, this is going to be a drubbing, because that's the way it felt, because they had scored from John McGinn from a free kick out on the sideline, which evaded everybody, including the goalkeeper, went into the corner. Then a few minutes later, they had a corner. They had an attacker completely unmarked at the back post. So they headed across goal and then tapped in by Dendonka for his first Aston Villa goal. And the crowd were actually booing when that ball hit the back of the net, because they anticipated that this was going to be another fiasco at Old Trafford. But I got to say, from the 26th minute onwards, I felt United dominated the game and were full value for the 3 points. But United are so poor at defending set pieces, and not particularly great I know Hoyland scored from a set piece after the ball ricocheted off John McGinn's shins or his knee, and then Hoyland hit it first time. But United don't often score from set pieces, with the exception of last night, and they concede a lot from set pieces like we saw last night. So 2.5 years into Eric Ramsey at set pieces, as the set piece coach, serious questions have to be asked. Chris, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, hard to disagree, Kyle. Yeah, it's, I don't know why we're not great at scoring from set pieces. I have no idea why that is. But you're right. I can't remember the last time really that I saw, you know, a set piece come in and somebody like Big Harry Maguire or something getting up and just rattling it into the back of the net with his head. You know, the point of those set pieces is that they give you a golden opportunity to ping a ball into an area that suits you and to play to your team's strengths. And that's what teams do all the time. That's just part of professional football. And I can't remember the last time that I felt United got a corner or a set piece and thought, we've got a good chance of scoring here. It's been a long time. Yes, okay. You know, the likes of Eriksen and Fernandez can take free kicks. Sometimes a dead ball, you think there's maybe an opportunity here. But even that's been quite a while. Rashford used to be maybe decent at them in the past too. But no, we're not great on set pieces. And I'd argue we're not great sometimes defending set pieces either. As you know, Kyle. So, you know, we're not great with set pieces either way. We're not great at attacking from them, and we're not particularly great at defending from them either. I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's personal attributes or it's down to the coach, as you mentioned. But, yeah, it hasn't been great for a long time, noticeably poor. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know where we go from here with it. Again, it'd be interesting to see if that's something that maybe Jim Radcliffe and that team picks up on, and then maybe they might do a bit of a switch up in some of those roles, given that scenario. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But yeah, we're not great on set pieces. I think that's pretty clear, to be fair.
Well, my understanding is that the manager decides who his staff is. So I don't think they would interfere like that. You know, they would choose the new, you know, co-owners will choose the coach, but after that, then he will choose who his subordinates are. So I don't think they'd be choosing his coaches for him. You know, that would be overstepping the mark in football.
I think Kyle, that was my veiled way of saying that they might choose a different manager, they may choose a different manager, as you know. And if they do, then that may change, but we'll see. Yeah.
I would still say that's highly likely at the end of the season, but Ten Hag has certainly helped his case with that win last night. Ten Hag was quick to point out that we had actually played well against West Ham, but just couldn't score. I think he was right up to a point. They did have several chances against West Ham, but once they conceded, they just collapsed. They were abysmal from that point onwards, and West Ham could have had several goals. But last night, they took more of the chances and won the game. I think West Ham against United was an abysmal game of football, and United should have been leading at half time, and you know, they should have scored before West Ham did. But as usual, Moyes was showing United a lot of respect by sitting back and soaking up pressure, when really his team got the tools and the arsenal to go at United and put them away. So I wasn't sure why it was down to West Ham allowing us to dominate possession, or was it a case of that we were decent in creating chances in that game? But against Aston Villa, who are one of the top teams in the league, I felt United, from the 26th minute onwards, I felt United were by far the better team. Just looking at the possession stats, we actually overall only had 46% possession. We had 13 shots to their 10, with 7 on target to their 4. We had less passes than them, 393, they had 462. And I felt, it just didn't feel like that. It felt as if we were dominating possession and chances. Is that how you saw it too, Chris?
Yeah, 100%, Kyle. I really felt, like you said, from, you know, that, 25, 26 minutes on, that was virtually all United. Absolutely. But if you think of those stats, actually, in a sense, tell the story, because we were pretty direct, if you think about it, you know, in the pressure that we're putting on. So in a sense, it doesn't surprise me. We actually had less possession, but more more shots, because in often, like I say, we had balls being pinged out to the right and the left, and we were just bearing down on goal, and everybody was pressing forward. So in some ways, I actually think those stats do tell the same tale, just in a slightly different way. It was all United. Even if we weren't playing the ball around, it always looked like we were the most likely to score from that point on. We looked to be putting the pressure on. Even the time that I mentioned where Eriksen was on the edge of the box and didn't shoot, you're looking at going, that's us knocking at the door. You know, that's us kind of creating chances, creating scoring opportunities. I felt like we definitely looked dominant. In a sense, the question became, would we be able to take any of those chances? As take them, and luckily, we were able to take a few. It was all United. It was all United from 25 on onwards, for sure.
Yeah, in the first half, typically, Garnacho played a ball across goal, but it was 5 yards in front of Hoyland. Now, you can decide who you want to blame. It was Garnacho not putting it into the right area, or was Hoyland too slow to get into the right area? But that's been happening all season. And the crosses are just not finding Hoyland. Quite often you see him, stretching or diving at crosses because they're, he's either not in the right area or it's not being played to him. It's too far in front of him.
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. I know the Garnacho one, I was looking at it and was thinking to myself, did he play too far in front of him? I mean, I think the ball, when it comes in, the defender's foot just misses it from memory. So that would make me think he played it as tight as he could. And that actually Hoyland probably should have read it a bit quicker and try to get across. In fairness to Hoyland, there are times when Garnacho shoots, I think, when he should cross. So, maybe Hoyland isn't always sure that Garnacho and Rashford similar, and probably Anthony similar too. There's maybe times he's not sure the guy's going to pass it to him or not. But I guess you could say, as a striker, he should always be running into those positions in anticipation. Yeah, it's hard to say. I'd need to say it again to really judge it, but the ball and the Hoyland was a bit slow getting there, but yeah, hard to say, really.
Yeah, there was occasions where Garnacho was having a shot when I thought the pass was on. I mean, there was one in particular that I remember where it went wide of the far post, and possibly he could have played in Hoyland, but don't want to be critical. I mean, Garnacho, most good things are happening through him. I think it was Ali McCoy said in commentary that it doesn't always come off, but he's always trying to make something happen. He's always running at people. Now, we've complained in recent weeks about, like, recent years, we complained about United wingers not going past people, but we saw lots of that last night from Garnacho. I'm so excited by the prospect of him playing on the right. I think I just said to you, at 2-1 down, Garnacho had just scored his first goal, and a few minutes later I said to you, Garnacho's having a big impact here on the right, and then he scores again and you're like, case in point. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. You called it well, in fairness, you called it well. Yeah, but he was brilliant. And you're right, Kyle, and that's not a criticism of Garnacho at all, because in fact he's a player who's confident, and I like to see that. I think you will, obviously, you do often find it, as players mature a little bit, that they're the times whenever they shoot when they should pass tends to come down, and they start to know exactly when they need to shoot versus when they should pass. So I think that will improve. But I mean, by and large, if he's coming and getting, two goals in games, or scoring the likes of the goal that he did a couple of weeks ago, I don't mind if he shoots all day long. Because he'll win us games doing that. So I think it's absolutely fine. It's definitely not a criticism. But yeah, I do think there are definitely some times when you look and you go, he's better passing it here, but he shoots. But yeah, it's a small criticism. It really is.
Well, we have to take into account that he's 19 and a half.
Exactly. That's it.
And I think it was Samuel Lookhurst who was writing today that he's actually better than what Ronaldo was at 19 and a half. His progression has been speedier. You know, Ronaldo frustrated us massively up until he was about 21, and then he really hit the ground running. So not saying Garnacho is going to be, you know, the monster that Ronaldo is, and he's going to break all these records, but he's definitely a better player at 19 than what Ronaldo was. So that's very promising. I would say that he's probably as good as what Rooney was when he was 19. Maybe that's too much praise, I'm not sure. But I want to see him.
I think that might be too much.
Yeah. But Rooney was still a developing player as well. I know Rooney, even at 16, he looked like a man. But and he was, you know, he wasn't your average 16-year-old. He was already, you know, capable of, you know, impacting games in the Premier League. But there were still some rough edges to smooth off. You know, he wasn't, you know, he didn't come into his peak until he was you know, into his early 20s. So, Garnacho is well ahead of schedule, I think. Now, in recent weeks, he's getting goals and assists, and I just want to see that become more consistent. I want to see by the end of the season his goals column and assist column, you know, really look, you know, fabulous on paper, and then next season increase those numbers again, and then we'll reap the benefits of that, because I think he's got, you know, the world's his oyster. I think he's got a very, very high ceiling, and I want to see him realize that potential. And I think he's got the right attitude. He's got the confidence. He's got the hunger. You see him how he treats young fans. He always has time for, you know, young boys who are, you know, they see him as their hero. You know, he always spends time with them. You see him stealing gifts with young supporters. So. He's certainly not arrogant or getting ahead of himself, but he does have, you know, confidence, and I think that's good. He just recently become a father as well, which will probably settle him down more and help him mature more quickly. And obviously he's in a steady relationship. So, if you remember, Ferguson wanted his player to settle down and have kids as young as possible, you know, to get them to mature. So he'd be happy with Garnacho's development, wouldn't he?
100%. Yeah, no, you're right. It does make me laugh that, but I can see the logic in it. Like, it's just funny the level of control that Ferguson tried to exercise at the club, but it clearly worked. I completely agree. Kyle, no, I'm a huge fan of Garnacho. It's brilliant to see him doing so well. Without getting into too much about it, I was a big fan of Greenwood. As you know, Kyle, I talked about him a lot in this podcast. I saw a lot of potential in him. And it was disappointing that things haven't clearly quite worked out for whatever particular reasons. But Garnacho is showing that same rise in terms of his ability and what he's able to do. And I didn't even realise, the comparison he made to Ronaldo is really, really good. I can't quite remember exactly what Ronaldo was like at 19, but you summed it up really, really well there. I mean, if he's even half on that trajectory, he's doing great things. And he's a phenomenal young player. And like I say, you know, I like to see that slight bit of selfishness in him because it shows confidence. It shows that he's confident. But again, as you highlighted, confident but not arrogant. And that seems to be, and that's just perfect. That's really what you want. Confident on the pitch and kind of humble off it, you know, and understand that he's in a privileged position. And it looks like that's what that guy has. So, yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan of his at the minute. He's playing extremely well. The criticism that I had, it wasn't really a criticism, but the thing that I pointed out about him, I think on the podcast before, was that at times he looked easily bullied off the ball. I'm not seeing that happen now anymore. I'm seeing him is completing more dribbles. I'm seeing him, he still gets chopped down, but he just does what Ronaldo and all great players do, takes it, gets up, walks on, forgets it even happened, and just goes at the same guy again and again and again. And you know, that's what you want to see, and he's definitely showing that. So, you know, he's coming on leaps and bounds in the short space of time that he's been at United, and if he continues on that trajectory and hopefully stays with us on that trajectory, he could be incredible. So it's watch this space, I think, with him. But he's already absolutely amazing. And hopefully he'll just get better. So yeah, I'm a massive fan.
and already has goal of the season in the bag, if, in the Premier League.
It'd be hard to top it.
Yeah, it would be. It'd be hard to top that this decade, never mind this season.
Absolutely.
Great to see him take his game to another level in recent weeks. Now, he did come in for some criticism against West Ham. He was being bullied off the ball a little bit in that game. He did miss chances in that game. But like Hoyland, he showed resilience. You know, doesn't let missing chances get him down or destroy his confidence. You know, he just keeps plugging away, keeps going, just moves on very quickly. You know, that's a great mentality to have, and it will help.
It's essential. You know, it's absolutely essential, Kyle. It definitely is. It's essential mentality to have. You can't be too emotional on a football pitch, ironically. You know, you have to be very, very focused, I think. And that's what all the great players are, absolutely focused, and he's showing that. I think it's great.
Yeah, you can't, at Manchester United, you can't allow kind of setbacks to destroy your confidence, otherwise you're just not going to make it. But yeah, he looks to have absolutely everything. And long may it continue. It's very, very exciting as a United fan. So I just wanted to come to Brush's concerns about the goalkeeper. He said the keeper is a cause for concern. He's never too far away from a clanger. Now, this has happened to several goalkeepers. What happened last night, a free kick from out on the sideline that evades everybody and goes in, and it doesn't look good when you're a goalkeeper. Now, he's probably had far worse errors this season than that. Similar to the first goal against West Ham, he probably had worse errors than that, but same time, it's not great. We cannot afford for him to be making, errors or half errors in every game. He did make a wonderful stop to deny them. I think it was, I can't remember what point it was at. Was it at 2-1 or 2-2? I think he stopped. I think it was Leon Bailey from scoring. But yeah, the first goal, he has to take criticism for that, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's. I mean, if I say anything in his defense, and I thought that overall last night he wasn't too bad. But Brush, I share your concerns, and I haven't been on the podcast for a few weeks, but I've been texting Kyle flat out about my concerns, so I wholeheartedly agree. But on giving a bit of balance to it, I think that whenever that ball comes across him, what he is looking for, he's looking for the touch from an attacker. So he's expecting that ball to not continue on its path, and he's expecting it to go across him one way or the other. So by the time it's actually everyone's missed it, it's too late for him to react. Now, like you say, Kyle, it's happened to lots of people, but it always looks bad. The problem is, if it happened to somebody who was on top form and we loved him and he was really reliable, you would just say it's one-off and it's unlucky. But given that we already have concerns about Onana, myself included, it just adds to the pile of negatives in the column, the negative column against him. He did. He made a good stop from, I think you said it was Leon Bailey. I also remember for one of the goals, I can't remember, I think it may have been Garnacho's second, possibly, he pings the ball right out to him. That was a great pass, and that's where we're hearing that was the reason why he was bought. I don't see him doing that virtually ever, so it's almost, I don't remember him doing it too often, and that's supposed to be his bread and butter. And that's my concern with him, is what he's meant to be really good at, he doesn't look to be all that good at. He does it every now and again, and the stuff that he's we should expect him to do as a basic, which is be a decent shot stopper. And I know he's got a hard act to follow in De Gea, but he's not particularly good at that either. So, yeah, I still have huge concerns. But given it last night, I think maybe he's unlucky for the first one. He made a decent save, and he did definitely play a good ball. I think it was to Garnacho for the second goal. So some positives there. But overall, yeah, he's not convincing me. He's definitely not.
So what does he get out of 10 in your book?
Based on last night, Kyle, I'll give him a 7. I mean, I don't think he did that much wrong, personally. And even though the person looks bad, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. So I give him a 7 for last night. But that's high for him because, yeah, I give him a lot less most weeks.
Okay. Wan-Bissaka had a decent game, so 6 out of 10. Varane and Johnny Evans. I suppose we had to factor in that we did concede 2 goals, so I'm just going to give them... I still think Johnny Evans was crucial to us winning the game, though. So I'm going to say Varane a 6 and Evans a 7. Dallow, I'll give him a 6. Had a decent game as a right-footed player playing at left back. And I don't care who the right-footed player is. I don't like to see them in that position. But the fact that we didn't really notice it, that's a good thing. And I would bring Luke Shaw back in there for balance against Forrest if he's available. The midfield, like I said, they were crucial to winning this game. I would persist with that midfield as well, at least until Casemiro comes back. Obviously, Eriksen's not going to play every game. Manu and Eriksen would get sevens. I give Bruno an 8. Alejandro Garnacho, I give him a 9. Not many 9s this season, so I enjoy giving those because it's been all too rare this season. Rasmus Højlund, I give him a 7. Finally breaking his duck in the Premier League. And Marcus Rashford, probably his best game this season, I'll give him a 7. And in terms of the bench, United were playing so well, he didn't make a sub until the 80th minute, would you believe? Now, he's not a man who loves making subs anyway. He does tend to leave it quite late, but you can excuse him last night because, they were dominating the game and there was no need to, interfere with that.
Just one other interesting thing, just to mention, Kyle. I don't know if you're noticing, but there's a lot more injury time this season. I know it's not a coincidence. A lot more injury time this season than what there was in the past. So even when we 5 minutes to go, I remember thinking in my head, that's 15 minutes left, and that's how it panned out. So actually, ironically, he brought those guys on with 20 minutes left to play. So, I mean, that's a late sub, but nowadays that's not that late a sub. Actually, it's still 20 minutes. Do you know what I mean? Just to make that point.
Yeah, the Premier League refs are now following the protocol from the World Cup in Qatar, where there was all kinds of injury time, 10, 15 minutes of injury time, and now we're seeing that in the Premier League. The groans from the crowd whenever the board went up and it said 9. And then there were a couple of stoppages within that 9 minutes, which extended it further.
I know.
So
I know. And it's totally expected now. And that's the thing, at 85 minutes, I went, I'll just wrap it up at 90. But I just knew rightly it was going to be close to 10 minutes because it just always is. So, yeah, it's unfortunately we get used to the fact that games are kind of 100 minutes now. They're not really 90 anymore, technically.
Yeah, they might as well change the laws of the game to 100 minutes and just save ourselves the time of just save the work of the fourth official adding on the extra 10 in every game. Because apparently the ball is only in play for about 60 minutes or something, maybe less. And was it Newcastle last season were only averaging about 50 minutes in play or something?
So in fairness, I actually agree with the rule for that reason, because you're a 90-minute game and you're getting like 50 minutes of football. That's a bit silly. I think the extra 10 minutes is fair, and the guys then have to play closer to actually to 90 as opposed to just being on the pitch for 90. So I think I don't think a bad thing personally.
Yeah, well, it's a bad thing when we're 3-2 up when we're playing against a good team at home,
Sorry, caveat, you're right, guys, you're right.
Yeah, when you're the team in front, it's always a bad thing.
Exactly. That's true.
None of the subs, apart from, even if you factor in the stoppage time, none of them are really on that long. I mean, as soon as just one comedy point to make was as soon as Hannibal Mary came on, I was like, come on, take a card, son, come on, you know you want to, because he always does. But I don't think he did in the end, but if you noticed him taking the ball to the corner with Bruno, I like that, I enjoy that.
He's good. I'm starting to warm to Hannibal. I didn't like him for a while, to be honest. I didn't like him. I just didn't think he was offering that much, but he's starting to grow on me for sure.
certainly doesn't lack in desire, that's for sure. And you know, desire has been questioned at Manchester United this season. He's very aggressive. But he's been a bit cheeky, you know, with the step overs and all when he was taking the ball to the corner, and then somebody just cleaned him then.
He just did what you were expecting him to do, which is just chop him down. Yeah, that's what you expect.
I remember one time we were playing against, was it Wigan in the League Cup final, and we were 4-0 up, and Ronaldo was flicking the ball under the back of his neck and all, just taking the absolute mick. I think that's
always
a bit too far.
Always a recipe for a booting, and that, like, I mean, you're going to get booted when you're going to do when you're doing that, you know what I mean?
It's great entertainment for the crowd, but when you're an opposition player, it infuriates you when players do that. You know?
Yeah, it's just pure cheek, like, just borderline disrespect, really.
It is funny, though. Dan Gore got a run out as well. McTominay got a run out, yeah. And Anthony, of course, too. But yeah, so Ten Hag, I'll give him a 7 out of 10 for last night, overseeing a Fergie era style win against Aston Villa. You've had many comebacks against Aston Villa. I know I referenced one earlier, the Makeda match, but I remember one even further back than that. I think it was in the FA Cup third round of Villa Park. We were 2-0 down, you know, very early on, and came back to win 3-2. I think Van Nistelrooy scored twice, maybe Solskjaer, you know, yeah. So we've had a few comeback wins against Aston Villa, and mostly wins in the Premier League year. Like I said, they've only beaten us 5 times. I was amazed at that stat. I thought in recent times they might have added to that because we've been so poor, but still only 5 wins the Premier League year. I mean, that's 30 odd years now.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that myself. I would have expected to be more. I mean, I suppose in the years I've been watching football, I suppose I don't remember them beating us very much. So I guess it does hold up, but obviously it is. It's a fact. But yeah, I still would have thought it would have been more than 5 times on the day. So yeah, interesting stat.
And their most famous win is without doubt the Alan Hansen, "You will not win anything with kids." That's opening day of the season, 1995.
That's right. That is right. Yeah. Alan got that one wrong.
Yeah, and United in the grey kits. I think David Beckham got the consolation that day. I think it was 3-1. It was 3-0, and then he scored an absolute whopper. No, like Beckham never scored a tap in, like, did he? It was always a goal from outside the area, wasn't it?
It was always a peach. Yeah. It was always a peach, yeah. To be fair, like, absolutely.
I think that's when he had, like, number 24 on his back or something. I think he went from 24 to 10 and then to 7.
Right,
Garnacho's making his way down. He's, like, 49. Down to 17, and then we anticipate he's going to be either 7 or 11 probably at some point. Well, given Hoyland's 11, he'll probably end up being 7. Current number 7 is starting to fill in to the same bracket as the other disappointing number 7s from the last 15 years. Half it to do with injury and half it to do with the fact that he hasn't done well when he's played, but still, I want to give him at least to the end of the season to prove himself, because we know there's a player in there. To be fair, he didn't come to United in the greatest of form. You know, and New Chelsea were a basket case last season. Still are. The only big team that's worse than us. And Mason Mount struggled there last season. So have to give him time to get back to his top form. He was on Twitter today, I think, congratulating Hoyland and getting his first goal. He's very happy for him, but I want to see him get his first goal now. You know, he's next on the list. I know you're a fan of the player. I'm sure you'd love to see him come good at Old Trafford.
I do. I like him, Kyle. I liked a lot of things about him at Chelsea, and said in the past when I saw him play for England, I just thought there was something about him. I just liked his work rate and his endeavour, and I thought he had ability. So, yeah, I'm busting to see him do well. I really do. I mean, I want every player that comes to United, I always want to see do well. Even if I didn't like them previously, I usually like them when they come to United, because it's United and you got to get behind the players. But no, I do quite like Mason Mount. So I'm disappointed it hasn't been working out for him yet. So, no, I would love to see him get fit again, get back in the team again and do well. And most importantly, like you say, Kyle, I'd love to see him get his first goal for the club. I would be only too happy. So it would be great to see him do well. So hopefully it's good to see that he's happy for his teammate. He's obviously staying involved with the squad, as you would expect. So hopefully he he can get back in and yeah, start to do well himself. Yeah, fingers crossed for him.
So, Chris, on Christmas Eve, we received probably an even bigger Christmas present than the win over Aston Villa at 4 o'clock that day. And that was the news we've all been waiting for 13 months now.
And has it only been 13 months, Kyle? It felt like 13 years.
Yeah, it has. It's really, really dragged. And even since we knew that this was going to happen, that was about a few months ago. So that process has dragged out as well. But finally, on Christmas Eve, it was announced that Sir Jim Ratcliffe has completed a 29% buy-in to Manchester United, as it turns out. That's 25% from the Class B shares agreed and the Class A tender ongoing. Then just over 4% from his injection of $300 million into the club. And it's been the plan for months to take extra shares in return for Ratcliffe's initial investment. So Ratcliffe is sitting on 29%, and the Glazers are now down to 49%. Now, as I've said to you off air, once that is reversed, then I'll feel more comfortable. I hope this is part of the Glazer exit strategy. And in the meantime, we're waiting on Premier League clearance. They have to scrutinise this deal, and it'll take 4 to 6 weeks. But in the meantime, the Glazers can't make any big decisions in terms of the coach, signing players, selling players, without consulting Jim Ratcliffe and Ineos. So, Chris, is this a step in the right direction?
I hope so, Kyle. I really hope so. This is the news I've been waiting for quite a long time, as I've said to you, and we've talked about it privately. You know, we talk a lot about new players, new managers, etc. This has been the thing I've been waiting for the most, because with every passing week, I keep hearing more things about what's going on at board level and executive level and things like that that just irritate me more than before. And not even just irritate me, it just, you know, speaks to the complete disarray and the kind of the toxic nature of what's going on behind the scenes. And no matter what players say, you know, and Bruno Fernandes said it last night, you know, they just concentrate on what's on the pitch. There's no way they can't be affected by things that go on behind the scenes. And often, actually, the performance on the pitch is directly affected, you know, when it comes to the likes of the story that you shared with me about Jude Bellingham being a near miss for the club because is him coming to see the club wasn't handled properly. I mean, that's a failure at recruitment level, board level, whatever way you want to put it. And that directly impacts things on the pitch. So it's been long, long overdue, as we've said, and I'm sure most United fans would agree, that there was some change beyond just the managerial team, the scouting team and the playing team. And hopefully this is the start of that. I think the thing that makes this seem very unusual is, and it's been talked about by other media outlets, is the fact that somebody with a minority stake is going to be given so much control over what is effectively the main business of the club, which is to be a football team. So it's quite unusual. You would say that it seems almost like too good to be true, but what makes me think that it is probably the case is the fact that, as we know, and we've been there'd be much maligned for it, is that the Glazers have so little interest in the football side of things that they're happy to let somebody else run it. And those who've been running up to now haven't done a particularly good job. So hopefully this is them just saying, okay, Jim Ratcliffe seems confident and seems keen to do it. It's your turn now, on you go. So I'm feeling pretty positive about it. In fact, I'm feeling pretty optimistic. So hoping that this is the start of things turning around. And like I've said before, Kyle, I really don't care who owns the club at all, as long as it's being run right. And I know I agree with you that I would really rather see likes of Jim Ratcliffe, or say that now, he hasn't done anything yet, but we, you know, in principle, at least we'd rather see him be the majority stakeholder and not the Glazers. But I really don't mind if it's the Glazers, as long as they just stay out of things, but actually, you know, have the decency to get good people in to actually run them and run them well. And hopefully this is the start of that. And if it is, I think it'll be a step in the right direction. Yeah, but we'll see how it pans out.
Yeah, well, even if the Glazers are silent partners, they still saddled the club with £700 million of debt. In fact, we're up to
agree.
A billion now. I think it's 700 million in terms of we owe the banks, and 300 million we owe other clubs. So it's an absolute disaster. And they leverage that debt against the club. It still baffles me how in 2005 that people were just allowed to take out a £700 million loan and then use that to buy, you know, one of the biggest sporting institutions in the world without putting in a single penny of their own money.
I just don't think it would happen nowadays. I know it's unfathomable, isn't it? Like, I don't think it would happen now, and it should never happen again, in my opinion.
Yeah, unfortunately here, I try not to think about it too much, but this is win-win for them. They've just pocketed $1.3 billion. And in addition to that, they have now absolved themselves of the responsibility for the football department, which means if things go wrong, then they can say, well, it's nothing to do with us. We weren't running the football department. I suppose financially, one of the better things that we've heard in the last few days is that there'll be no dividend payments, at least for the next 3 years, which Radcliffe has negotiated. Radcliffe does not see the need for shareholders to take dividends, which is music to my ears, because it was another thing that was infuriating over the last, you know, few years is the amount of dividends that the Glazer siblings were taking out of the club when we were doing so poorly on the field.
Absolutely. The other thing that I would add, just on your point you're saying there about they can absolve themselves off any blame for things going wrong on the football side, I would slightly disagree with that. Not with your statement. I understand where you're coming from, but I would say it's still their fault, because it was their choice to hang on to the club. It's their choice to not sell the club in its entirety. So everything that happens right now, including Radcliffe coming in, it's all their choice. And even if Radcliffe does extremely well, I won't be saying, you know, even though I'm saying I don't mind who owns the club, but it won't be because of the Glazers. It'll be in spite of the Glazers, in spite of the fact that they want to hang on to squeeze the club for every single penny they can drain from it. And that's all that, and as like you say, that's all this really is. That's why they're doing it this way, because they want to overinflate what Jim Radcliffe's going to pay. That if he does eventually buy the whole club, it's at a ridiculous price that the club isn't really worth, but they're demanding, because, you know, they're so money orientated. It'll be in spite of them. So, you know, I'm not, when I say that I don't care if they let things run right, I just mean from a typical fan perspective watching the games. But in terms of morally, I think everything they've done has been absolutely disgraceful. How they've treated the club with absolute contempt. They've been the worst custodians possibly in the history of the club. I don't think there's been too many worse. And I think, yeah, the sooner they're not involved at all, absolutely the better. But I guess, yeah, just saying that for now, from a purely football perspective, it seems a step in the right direction. And if they stay and they stay out and let good people run it, that's good enough for now. But no, in the long term, I want them to go. Same as most fans probably do.
And more good news is that if the Glazers decide to sell more stock, and say a third party offers, you know, the chance to buy a 25% stake, and it meets, you know, the asking price, then Jim Radcliffe has the opportunity to match that. He gets first refusal. And you'd think if somebody came along and wanted to buy their own, you know, 25% stake or whatever it is, Radcliffe would step in right away, because we get the sense that his ambition is to have complete control of the club. So, exactly. And he's already shown that he's willing to overpay for shares. So if somebody offers the Glazers, you know, well over the asking price for more shares, then he undoubtedly will match that. So
I think you're right.
Hopefully in time, that I think it will be a bit like the Glazers themselves. They were minority owners originally, you know, from 2002 to 2005, and gradually increased their share. So hopefully that's what he does, him and Ineos do. They gradually increase their shares and then become the majority owners and then full owners, hopefully. And then we can forget about the Glazers completely. Now, in the meantime, Ineos executive Sir Dave Brailsford and Jean-Claude Blanc will be directors at the football club. I'm assuming Blanc will assume the role of CEO once this is ratified and Brailsford will be a director. Brailsford was at the match last night, and it was so predictable that with every goal that went in, that the camera kept panning to him to see his reaction. But he was completely poker face, wasn't he, from minute 1 to 90?
Completely, yeah. No, I noticed that myself. He was getting a lot of attention from the cameras, and he didn't seem to be showing anything either way, good or bad. Yeah, you're completely right. And fair play to him. He's better if the cameras would be on the whole time, so he just kept stony faced. So I think that your summation there of the role sounds about right. So it'll be interesting just to see how it pans out.
Yeah, I think he didn't want to show how happy or angry he was either way, so he didn't react to anything that was going on last night. There's some pretty sinister Andrew Glazer chanting again from the start of the match, as I was saying to you. I'm not sure it's broadcastable, to be honest with you.
No, I don't think it is broadcast. I don't think it is broadcastable.
Yeah.
And I can't say we can do that, in fairness. And despite how much I dislike the Glazers, which is clear. It was probably a bit rough. But fair enough. I understand people aren't happy with them, as I am not too happy myself. But yeah.
Yeah, I understand their anger, but I wouldn't go to that extreme if, you know, I'm just not the type of person really. Yeah, but things are looking on the up. So as I said, $300 million investment into the infrastructure, which will only touch the size really. There's an architectural firm are advising Jim Radcliffe to knock Old Trafford down and rebuild it. Of course they are, because if they rebuild something, they would make more money in that instance. So I'm not surprised that the architectural firm is giving that advice.
Yeah, so you're a very cynical man, Kyle, a very cynical man. Yeah, sorry, I'm only joking. Yeah, I completely agree. Absolutely, flipping heck, it's in their interest. Yeah, and I wonder who would do the architectural work on that. Would it be the same firm or...
Yeah, they're obviously looking for the deal. Yeah, but what are your views on it anyway? Some fans are very sentimental and they don't want to see Old Trafford come down. And other fans think that we need to modernise and have a stadium like Tottenham. What do you think?
I know it's always one I debate with in my mind, to be honest, Kyle. You know me by now. I am quite a sentimental supporter, probably, and I do like the tradition and values and all those things. So my gut tells me I would rather see us try to make the best of the stadium that we have. But that said, you can't fight off modernization forever. Eventually we would probably have to modernize. And at the end of the day, it's just a new set of walls. You know, if it's built on the same place, you know, it's still Manchester United. It's still, you know, where it is today. You know what I mean? It's still right in the same community that it's in. So I don't think you're ripping down everything that ever went before. And this is, you know, brand new, and it's got nothing, you know, no history about it. I think that, you know, you can still have a new set of walls, a new stadium, but still, you know, in the same area, maintain, you know, it's linked to the community, can maintain its history. So I don't think it's the end of the world if we did go down that road. I wouldn't fight against it personally. But yeah, I think if it was me, I'd be hoping, is there ways to try and modernize what we have, but not, you know, start from scratch. But I wouldn't be too annoyed if they did, I guess.
The structure of the stadium has changed many times. I mean, if you look at what its appearance from the early 90s, you wouldn't even recognize it, you know, from today.
You're right. Exactly. Yeah.
So you could say that it's already been knocked down and replaced. So yeah, I wouldn't be against modernization and turn it down and rebuilding it on the same site. Yeah, obviously I wouldn't want the stadium to be 5 miles away or 10 miles away or something. I want it to be on the same site.
Same,
but that's the most important thing, I feel. Yeah. But that would cost probably cost two. You see the modern stadiums, the best stadiums in the world, you'd have to say now, that they built in the likes of Las Vegas and New York and California. They cost like $2 billion. So $300 million investment wouldn't even touch the sides.
It's just a new lick of paint.
But I think that's just the initial investment. Maybe that's just fixing the leak in the roof, and you know, a few other things. Apparently the electrics are going to be outdated soon as well. according to the architectural firm. So
didn't know that. I wonder will any of that go towards some of the training facilities as well? Something Ronaldo complained about, wasn't it, that he said accounting hadn't changed the day since he left it, and so it, you know, his summation at least means that it needs an upgrade. So maybe it'd be something to go into that too.
He said that at the bottom of the pool in Carrington there was a tile missing, and it was still missing when he came back like 12 years later. Astonishing, really.
It's not great.
That was the lack of investment from the Glazers. That really highlighted it, how little they cared about the football club. That they wouldn't even replace a tile. I couldn't believe this. I think it was the Athletic who wrote the article a few years ago. They said that when Mourinho wanted a new desk in his office, that had to be signed off by Joe Glazer. Can you believe the micromanagement that was going
That is absolutely ridiculous. Oh, my word. A new desk for, a few hundred quid or whatever it would cost, and he had to sign that off. No, that's just absolutely ridiculous. But does not surprise me, Kyle. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest. I know I eulogise a lot about the Glazers, and I'm really not a big fan, but how I see them is I've sort of, you know, equated in my mind, it'd be the equivalent of me buying, you know, and this is with not any disrespect, I don't really follow cricket, and I don't take much of an interest, for example, in what goes on a cricket field. It'd be the same as me saying I'm gonna buy a cricket club, you know, and knowing that I have no interest in what goes on that pitch or where how they perform. All I care about is, am I making money off this investment or not? And that's to me how the Glazers see United. I don't think they treat the club with contempt, although it does seem that way. I think it's just pure disinterest, where they do not care about anything except, are they making money? And they have been for a long time. And so they're happy enough to keep making money. They don't care whether we have the worst team in the league or not, unless that impacts them making money. It's a cynical view, but I think I've come to the conclusion in my mind that that's kind of how they view the club. Which is sad, really, because it's such a great institution, and they clearly don't value it.
And we're going to find it very, very unusual seeing one of our owners investing his own cash into the club. We haven't experienced that for... Has it ever happened?
I know. Well, yeah, it probably hasn't ever happened, yeah. And he seems to actually like football. He actually likes football. He's interested in do they win a game or not. I mean, that's, you know, massive step forward considering what we've had up till now. Somebody actually cares about whether they win a match or not.
I think I said to you, the Glazers are happy to finish top four every season and get the Champions League revenue, because and they weren't interested in winning the competition, because the difference between the last 16 and the final is about 20 million. To spend money on the players to get us to win a final would cost way in excess of 20 million. So they didn't care about that. Whereas Radcliffe, I feel fourth place wouldn't be enough for him. He wants to win. And I was watching Sir Dave Brailsford on the Diary of a CEO podcast, and he's an enormously driven individual. He's all about winning. You know, anyone who follows cycling will know all about him and his marginal gains concept. So, it's well worth checking out, United fans. All about Dave Brailsford's career and cycling and how he's taken that into the likes of Nice and now Manchester United. So, he feels that improving, taking baby steps in every area can then make a massive difference. Even, you know, very, very small details, if you keep improving them 1% each time, then in the long run, it'll make a big difference. It's well worth reading about. But these guys want to win. You know, finishing fourth will not suffice, and that's very, very important to me.
100%. Absolutely. You know, I feel like if the Champions League money that comes in was given to every club in the Premiership, no matter of where they finished, then I don't think the Glazers would care if we finished 17th or first. I don't think it would matter to them. And that's the difference, like you say, Kyle, is that, you know, hopefully it seems like the people we have coming to the club now actually want Manchester United to be a successful football team, not just a successful business. And it seems like the, you know, likes of Dave Brailsford see sporting success as being integral to who he is as a person, and his whole kind of ethos. And so if they can bring that, then hopefully that'll be to our benefit. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Marginal gains is a theory that small yet significant improvements can lead to monumental results. So I even heard a few of these minor changes that Brailsford was proposing for, like, cyclists, for example, you know, to improve their performance. And some of them are, you can make your own mind up. You might laugh at some of them and think that's not going to make a difference. Even right down to when you're staying over in a hotel room and before the night of a race or a match, that you'd bring your own pillow from your house with you, because it might help you sleep better. You know, something as small as that. You know, and you know, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, but it makes perfect sense. It absolutely does. You know, anything that, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, anything that improves performance by a little bit. And the thing about it is as well, Kyle, particularly whenever at the level that Manchester United operate at, you know, in the Premier League, you know, every player that you come up against in the Premier League is an outstanding footballer. Every team is going to be well organized. They're going to be fit. They're going to have, you know, they're athletes. You know, they're going to be doing everything really, really well. So, you know, I think that you need every small little marginal gain, you know, as they call it, that you can get. So yeah, I think those small things, it makes absolute sense to try and maximize those. Definitely does.
See, before Brailsford took over British cycling, they hadn't won. No British cyclist had ever won an event in 110 years, and they absolutely dominated the sport since. Apparently, he was talking on the podcast that Britain had. They won one gold medal in the Atlanta Olympics in 1996. And then he came in after that. Just obviously he was only working on the cycling end of things, but yeah, that's obviously changed big time. So he's obviously I think he has a degree in psychology and all as well. So he's, you know, he's a very smart individual. So hopefully he can bring that concept to United. So he believes that improving every minor detail by 1%, then you can have a monumental change. So let's see how that works out. It'd be hard to believe that other clubs aren't doing this. You know, I'm sure they pay attention to minor details as well. That's probably why Man City and Liverpool have been successful in recent seasons. I feel as if we've fallen way behind in terms of sports science under the Glazers. We have not modernized at all, and that's why we've been struggling. One of the reasons why we're struggling is kind of how we've ignored, you know, data analysis and sports science. Yeah, we are just we're stuck in the dark ages when it comes to that sort of thing. So I would like to think that any of us are going to, you know, bring us up to speed with all that.
Yeah, but also, Kyle, I mean, at the very least, you know, I feel like at the very least, it's about setting a culture. You know, you can talk about marginal gains, you know, and 1% of things, but what it really all come in a way it creates is a culture of excellence. You know, a culture of striving for the absolute, you know, maximizing every little bit of talent that's within the team, and, you know, and absolutely maximizing that to achieve its maximum potential. And I, you know, I think, you know, Ferguson, you know, wasn't dissimilar when going back to Ferguson, our last successful, you know, manager. He talked about small things, like he said, you know, the team absolutely had to wear the Manchester United blazers or suits, you know, going to games, things like that. That was the similar philosophy. You know, that wearing a blazer doesn't make you play well on a football pitch. Oh, but all it does is it drills into you discipline and drills in a culture of we are an organization here that strives for the best, and we want to be the best at everything we do. We want to look the best. We want to play the best. And that's what it's about. And I think that that 1%, you know, marginal gains seems similar. It's just about achieving excellence, you know, in every single area. And that can only be positive.
Yeah, in the beginning, there is basically no difference between making a choice that is 1% better or 1% worse. In other words, it won't impact you very much today. But as time goes on, these small improvements or declines compound, you suddenly find a very big gap between people who make slightly better decisions on a daily basis and those who don't. This is why small choices don't make much of a difference at the time, but add up over the long term. And that's the thought behind that. So hopefully you can bring that to United, and if it works, then brilliant. But yeah, he's going to be heavily involved in, I think the process is already underway, on deciding of doing basically an audit of Manchester United and seeing what changes need to be made on the inside. I already know that Radcliffe, like United apparently have 1,000 employees, and Radcliffe said that's way too many and could cut as many as 250 or 300. I hope it's not the people at the bottom that are being cut on. It's they feel that there's far too many, big jobs at the club, and there's no need for them. There's probably, you often hear about the amount of scouts that there were under Ed Woodward that he recruited from a recruitment agency. And there's so many coaches and data analysts and all. I just wonder, and so many executives, a bloated comms team. I just thinking there's a lot of jobs for the boys going on there potentially, and the number of staff probably does need to be cut. We want a situation where.
Sorry, Kai. Go ahead.
We want quality, not quantity.
Absolutely. Well, you're exactly right. And it also speaks to an organization set up to not focus on football, an organization that has swelled to focus on other things. And that's what's been wrong for too long. And I think, yeah, if we can trim that back and, like you say, kind of focus on quality, not quantity, and focusing in strengthening the areas that are important to a football club, not just important to commercial success. And refocus attention, then I think that will be an improvement.
Radcliffe has been very complimentary towards the commercial success. He obviously doesn't believe that much improvements are needed in that area of the club, but he feels as if the revenue that we're making from the commercial success needs to be used much better than it has been. And I think it was a journalist who said that the Glazers basically handing over the sporting department is an admittance of failure, and it has been a spectacular failure, and it's about time somebody else took on the role.
100%, and it's absolutely no shock that they've been successful in the commercial side and that he's praising that. I mean, they focus so much energy and attention and recruitment and on it. I mean, I would expect that world-class businessmen are able to get that right when they put their efforts into it, and they have. So I would expect that to be successful. It's the fact that they've done it to the detriment of everything else, and that's what needs to be reshifted. It's just that balance of the focus, needs to be reshifted. Let the commercial department run itself and do the good job, but also strive for the same level of success in the sporting department. Have a world-class commercial output, but also with a world-class sporting output, rather than just having one and not the other. I think that's hopefully what they'll seek to kind of redress.
Yeah, so the next step is to get it ratified by the Premier League, and then they can officially get their feet underneath the table and start and begin their work. And I think the next crucial appointment is the director of football. I think we know that Blanc is going to be the CEO, so director of football is going to be an interesting one. Many, many candidates have been linked, and all the names are very exciting, because they have a track record of, being able to not only unearth, diamonds in the rough, but also sell players for really good fees. We failed to do both of those things in the last 20 years. So I'm looking forward to seeing who the new director of football is going to be. It seems that any of us believe that the director of football should be like a no way in American sports they have like a general manager, and he's like almost he's like one of the most important figures in the club. Well, that's the way any of us see a director of football, see him being very much central to everything. So okay. Looking forward to seeing who that's going to be. Rather than he might still keep the title as manager, but he'd be more of a head coach. You know, that's more kind of very modern in football now, where you don't quite often they don't have the title manager, they have the title head coach. And whether he keeps the title manager or not, he's going to be a head coach, whoever that may be, whether it be Ten Hag or somebody else. And so you'll have the head coach, and you have the director of football above him, and then the CEO above him. So yeah, we've needed so much change in those roles. I mean, you alluded to it earlier, John Murta. The stories in that Athletic article about him were deeply troubling, not least when Jude Bellingham came to Carrington on Old Trafford, when he was at Birmingham, when he was leaving the club and would decide on his next move, and Bellingham was shaking hands with Sir Alex, and John Murta interrupted and took Bellingham on a tour of the Old Trafford facilities. But it was part of the plan by Solskjaer. After Solskjaer and his coaches did a presentation to Bellingham, that Ferguson would then talk to him, you know, and hopefully persuade him to join Manchester United. And Murta interrupted, and the player ended up going to Dortmund. I mean, that's a cycle of offense in itself. But another thing that I couldn't believe is that Murta wanted to leave and go to Inter Miami, David Beckham's club, and get probably a well-paid job there. But Woodward and Joe Glazer didn't want to lose him, so they made him football director. They created a new role for him, give him a pay raise in order to keep him. I'd have just let him go. I mean, so they were so desperate to keep this guy, they created a role for him. And yeah, I don't really see what he has brought to the table. We've seen Ten Hag basically have almost complete control of incomings, and it's not a good thing, because you've got nobody there to tell him that this is not good value, we can get a better player than this. So Ten Hag is just able to bring in all these players that he's familiar with from the Eredivisie. And Murta doesn't seem to have... I think Murta had input into the Casemiro signing. He was setting that one up in case the Frankie de Jong transfer didn't come off, which it didn't, and then they were ready to go with Casemiro. We can make our own minds up if that was a good thing or not, paying £70 million for a 30-year-old. I certainly know that Jim Ratcliffe's been on record criticising that transfer, and we won't see that under him, paying that kind of money for a 30-year-old on those kind of wages. But yeah, John Murta, I don't think he's been a success at all, and that Athletic article from Roy Whitwell was pretty damning, wasn't it?
Absolutely. You're right, and that's exactly what I was alluding to earlier. You know, that's just toxic. And that is, it's not even toxic, Kyle. It's just dysfunctional. I think that's a better word. It's dysfunctional. It's people not being on the same page as each other. It's not having an actual plan that everybody has given their say on and everybody's agreed to. It's people going off and doing their own thing. You know, Solskjaer had one idea of what should have happened there, and maybe it was a good idea, maybe it was not. But either way, it was a plan. And, you know, there was at least a couple of people on board with that, you know, including Sir Alex Ferguson himself, obviously. And then the fact that, you know, John Murta comes in, who's supposed to be, you know, their boss effectively, and just torpedoes the whole thing at no notice. I mean, that's just dysfunctional. You know, it's just a poor way to run any organization or any department, or run any sort of half, you know, sort of professional, you know, setup. It's just not professional, and that's the problem. And that's just one example of why things are not good at Man United, because it's just nobody really seems to have an actual plan. And if they do, it seems like that it's one of many plans. And if you have lots and lots of plans and no single plan, well, you know what I'm going to say. You don't have any plan in at all. And that's been the issue, is that we're a world-class elite sporting organization that doesn't have an actual plan, or certainly not a plan that everybody agrees to. That's really, really poor. And that's the reason why it needs an overhaul. It's poor.
And we also read that article that he fell out with Nicky Butt. They had a blazing row in the canteen. They couldn't work together then after that, which is why when Murta got that role as football director, there was a technical director post to go along with it, and it went to Dorn Fletcher rather than Butt, because Butt couldn't work with Murta. That's so dysfunctional as well. So with Butt missing out on promotion, he then handed in his notice. So Murta had fallen out with Sir Alex, he had fallen out with Nicky Butt, and he was overruling Solskjaer on a key recruitment plan with Bynum. And you're like, this guy is just a disaster. And who does he think he is? You know, we're all familiar with Ferguson, Solskjaer, and Butt. They're all people that we value. You know, people have great history at the club. Who the hell is John Murta? We're like, piss off. Who do you think you
exactly.
are?
Exactly. But the problem is, Kyle, and this is, you know, and we're not going to get into chatting about the manager, but this is the problem, is that who would get the blame for that? The manager, because that's how it always goes. And the fact that we are familiar with those players means that's who we look to. But in reality, it's this person with a lot of power, you know, behind the scenes, pulling the strings, making these mistakes, you know, vetoing what may or may not have. I mean, let's be honest. Nobody in their right mind would argue that buying Jude Bellingham wasn't a good idea. So it was a good idea, because he's absolutely brilliant. So it was good. It would have been a good idea to buy him. And John Murta clearly torpedoed that, whether he meant to or not. He was a big role in stopping that from happening. All that does is pull the rug from underneath the manager, and it sort of undermines his position as the manager in the eyes of everybody at the club, including the players, and even, you know, undermines Alex Ferguson's position as well. I mean, that's really bad, and it creates a culture where people say, doesn't matter what Solskjaer says to me, because it's what John Murta says. That's what really counts. What he says is what will go. Who cares what Solskjaer says? That creates that lack of fire in people's bellies in the dressing room, because they'll go, I don't really have to do what the manager tells me, because he's not really even the boss around here. That and even if he doesn't think it, but it just even creeps in a little bit of the psyche, that's detrimental. Once again, it's just not prioritizing what's important for sport. It's prioritizing what's important for commercial or some other thing, or letting the person have free rein because they're good in a commercial sense. And regardless if they're sporting acumen or they're sporting intelligence, that's just Man United at the minute. So yeah, it needs to change.
And once again, he's another lackey who was, you know, promoted through the ranks at Old Trafford internally. When we created the role of football director, we should have been appointing the best in class, the best possible person in Europe to take on that role, not giving somebody a promotion at the club. It's just all rewarding loyalty. It's a typical Glazer policy that, you know, anyone we trust will promote them and give them a pay raise, you know, and create roles for them and all that. That's just not a recipe for success, as you say.
No, it's not at all. In fact, Kyle, it makes you think that was he a football director, or was he at all, or a sporting director? It was just a name to give that you could put on paper and hand him the salary to go along with it. But, you know, it doesn't sound like he was ever actually qualified for that job. So it means he's just a person, like you say, get a promotion. Well, what will we promote him into? Well, football director or sporting director, we'll stick that name down. You know what I mean? But it's not actually that person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the article in The Athletic was saying that his qualities are as an administrator. You know, he's not a true, you know, football director, really, that you see at other clubs. He doesn't perform all the tasks that they do.
He's not a football director at all. Then.
Yeah, and he'd never done that job before. How can you do a job for the first time at Manchester United? You know, your first experience of a role is when you're given it at Manchester United. That's absolutely absurd.
It is. It really is, Kyle. You know, again, coming back to the fact that Man United are a world level elite sporting organization, you know, you have to earn your role at that. You know, we expect and you know, you aim for the best in class or close to it, you know, and that's right. You know, people shouldn't be cutting their teeth in Manchester United. You know what I mean? That's pretty bad.
Well, I hope that he's moved on and he can finally take up his role at Inter Miami, because given everything that I know about him, I'm not impressed. So just coming on to comment here from Zamari, he says, do you think Ten Hag would have signed Ronaldo had he been there before his arrival? No, I don't think so. They didn't get on very well at all, did they?
No.
And you know,
no,
Ronaldo,
I don't think he would have done either.
Ronaldo got himself out of there by doing that interview with Piers Morgan, which apparently he regrets now, was what I've heard. But yeah, they were like chalk and cheese. The thing is with Ronaldo, he would have been a great asset as a bench player, a rotational option, but he was never going to accept that because Ronaldo's biggest goal is like what motivates him the most is breaking all the goal scoring records. And if he's like sitting on the bench, only coming on as a sub or, you know, only starting once every three or four games, that's going to be detrimental to him breaking goal scoring records. So somebody suggested to me on this podcast that, you know, Ronaldo should just be happy as a rotational option and at his age, and that would benefit, you know, everyone. But I was thinking to myself, his ego is just never, ever going to accept that. And that's exactly what happened.
And that's the problem. And you and I talked about it at the time, I think, and I think I said the same thing to you, that from the manager's perspective, I can see why he's saying this guy is, you know, albeit he is kind of superhuman in some ways in the terms of his fitness for his age. I'll give him that, of course. But, you know, it was obvious that, you know, from a manager's perspective, it was a fair ask to say, he'll come on the bench and he'll be the best ever impact sub you could think of. But no, that's right. He would never accept it. So it was never gonna fly. It was just never gonna work. So I don't think that Ten Hag would have voluntarily signed him either, to be honest. Don't think so.
It is a shame because he would have been a much better option than Vikhorst. And this season with Rasmus struggling in the Premier League, it would have been great to have Ronaldo there as another option rather than Martial, who we all know is useless. So if Ronaldo's ego wasn't so big, it would have been helpful for us to have him there as a rotational option, but it was never going to happen.
Unfortunately not.
So yeah, for a start, Ronaldo was never played in the Eredivisie, so I don't think Ten Hag would have signed him. So we shall wrap it up there. Everyone, please drop us a like on the video if you're watching on YouTube. Subscribe to the channel, get more of your thoughts in, and if you're listening on Apple or Spotify, thank you for all the downloads and listens, and all big fans of the show out there, please retweet on X or on Facebook or Instagram and tell your friends about the show, and let's increase our listener base. So Chris, it has been a pleasure as always.
You too, Kyle. Enjoyed it as always. Yep. And glad to be on a nice wee win again. So that's always good. Hopefully that'll continue.
Okay. I'll see everyone after the Nottingham Forest game on December 31st.